Chapter 5. Race and Politics. Few mixtures are more volatile than race and politics. The normal frictions and resentments among individuals and groups seldom approach the magnitude of frenzy and violence produced by the politicization of race. The 20th century, which has seen the spread of mass politics and mass ideologies to vast new regions of the globe, has also been the century of resurgent new racial persecutions reaching new heights or depths. The political ideal of the right of self-determination of nations has created new nations which used their newfound power to persecute their own minorities, first in Europe after World War I, then in much of Asia and Africa after World War II, and in the Balkans and the Caucasus after the respective breakups of Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union. The 20th century has also seen the need for a new word, genocide, to describe what happened to the Armenians during the First World War, and what happened to the Jews during the Second World War. A world shocked by the deaths of 6 million people during the Holocaust has been much less aware of the deaths of an estimated 10 million people killed in various parts of the world since World War II for belonging to the wrong racial or ethnic group. The direct role of politics in shaping racial and ethnic attitudes and policies is only one facet of political influences on race and culture. Many policies not intended as racial or ethnic nevertheless have disparate impacts on different groups. Public utility regulation, occupational licensing, or minimum wage laws can have profound and usually adverse economic effects on poorer minorities. Some political arrangements, however, can ameliorate racial frictions and help diffuse racial tensions, while other political circumstances can transform harmonious group relations into mutual bloodletting in the streets within a few years' time. Political power, political institutions, and political ideologies have had both short-run and long-run effects on the economic and cultural fate of racial and ethnic groups, as well as on their ability to survive at all. Political systems, like economic systems, need to be examined in terms of the incentives they create, rather than simply the goals they pursue or the philosophies or ideologies which shape those goals. Moreover, it would be a serious mistake to think of the blacks, the Jews, or the Chinese as unified entities consistently pursuing group self-interest. Leaders, as well as those striving for leadership within these and other groups, have their own agendas and their own personal career goals, and they respond to the political incentives which affect these agendas and goals, whether or not their responses advance the well-being of the groups in whose name they speak. This is not to say that all political leaders are cynical manipulators. It is to say that those most likely to survive and thrive in political competition are those more attuned to the exigencies of the political process, whether by intention or happenstance. Political institutions. Political systems are essentially systems of power, and their relative effectiveness for different purposes reflects that central fact. Government may use its power to forbid, coerce, confiscate, punish, or expel. Goals achievable by these means are well within the effective control of government. Goals which depend upon the creativity, skills, thrift, work habits, organizational abilities, and technological knowledge in the population at large are much less within the power of incumbent officials to achieve within a politically relevant time period. In the short run, within the term of office of elected officials, for example, government can do little to increase substantially these sources of economic prosperity. It can also do little to change the people's traditions, attitudes, wisdom, and tolerance, or intolerance, inherited from the past, all of which constrain the options of existing power holders and determine the stability and viability of the governmental structure itself. Political leaders in some countries, Malaysia, the Philippines, Nigeria, Sri Lanka, and Guyana, for example, have exhorted their own people to develop the dynamism exhibited by envied minorities in their midst. There is, however, little evidence that these exhortations have been effective. Where the power of government has produced immediate effects has been in reducing existing productive capabilities by excluding, restricting, or expelling the groups possessing those capabilities. From the expulsions of the Jews from Spain in 1492 to the expulsions of Indians and Pakistanis from Uganda in 1973, this has been a way to achieve immediate political goals, though at lasting economic costs. Government may also use its power to confiscate the wealth of some and transfer it to others, but this too is usually only a short-range benefit to the recipients and an overall loss to the country, as the plundered group usually reduces its production of wealth, whether because of the lack of incentives, or because their wealth is hidden or sent abroad, or because they themselves leave for more hospitable countries. The negative consequences of political persecution and plunder are not limited to economic losses. Medical, cultural, and even military losses may be sustained by the country at large. After expelling the Jews, Spain later complained that its Muslim enemies had been able to put to military use the knowledge obtained from Jewish refugees from Spain. Similarly, in the 20th century, Jewish refugees from an increasingly anti-Semitic Europe, notably Albert Einstein and Edward Teller, helped make the United States the first nuclear power. In short, the ability to exert political power does not imply an ability to achieve what one wishes to achieve with that power, or even an ability to avoid overwhelming negative repercussions. Control of political power can, however, sometimes be used to enlarge the options of society at large in two very different ways. In relations between governmental units, the more powerful unit can reduce the counterproductive activities of the less powerful units. Thus, in mid-20th century America, the federal government of the United States eliminated extensive racial discrimination laws in the southern states. Independent political units may also voluntarily agree to mutual reductions of their counterproductive activities. For example, when Germany was a fragmented collection of states and principalities, tariff and other barriers to trade among these numerous political entities severely handicapped the economic development of the whole region. By agreeing to remove many of these barriers when they formed the Zollverein, or customs union, in the early 19th century, these states and principalities freed the peoples of that region to develop the great human and natural resources already present. With the essential resource of government being power, its essential mode of operation is the use of that power to constrain the options of people and organization within its jurisdiction. All too often in history, government has constrained the options of racial and ethnic minorities much more so than it has constrained the options of the majority population. That has been true of independent republics like the United States, colonial regimes like those in Malaya or Australia, dynastic states like Japan or the Ottoman, Russian, or Habsburg empires. In addition to such deliberate racial differentiation in the application of power, the general functioning of government and politics often has a racial impact, even when the intentions and explicit laws and policies are not racial. Among the political institutions which greatly affect the fate of racial and cultural groups are, first, law and order, second, democracy, third, political parties, fourth, the military, and sometimes, fifth, foreign governments in the homelands of particular racial or ethnic groups. These all have the potential for both positive and negative effects. Law and order. One of the most important ways in which government's ability to reduce people's options can be used to increase other options is by maintaining the general conditions of law and order. This reduces everyone's options to inflict violence or to practice theft against others. But law and order is more than a zero-sum process, because the increased security it produces increases people's options to do things other than spend vast amounts of time and resources safeguarding their own belongings and personal safety. It is only because virtually everyone prefers losing the first set of options in order to have the second that law and order represent a clear social gain. Even criminals do not want general lawlessness or anarchy, for that would mean that each criminal would have to barricade himself in his home before daring to fall asleep and could not enjoy his ill-gotten gains in peace. The economic importance of law and order is enormous in a wide variety of contexts. Land, subject to marauding raids, is less likely to be farmed, regardless of its fertility. Such insecurity caused much land to lie idle in parts of Scotland and in parts of Africa, before outside conquerors subjugated the local combatants or raiders in both places, imposing peace under foreign hegemony. The great overland routes through Central Asia that allowed medieval Europe to trade with the Orient varied greatly in their usability, according to whether each route was all under one political hegemony, as in the days of Genghis Khan, or whether trade through the region was subject to lawless raids and numerous local extortions. Parts of southeastern Europe were virtually unpopulated during the era of Turkish raids there, and then became densely populated after the late 18th century, when those raids ceased. The new security permitted crops to be grown, where before there were only a few herdsmen who could flee with their animals in the face of danger, whereas immobile crops in the field would have been burned by marauders. Law and order are not necessarily just. Their economic benefits depend more on their stability and predictability than on their even-handedness. Groups clearly given second-class status in the law have nevertheless prospered in stable societies where that law has protected their persons and property. Often they have prospered more so than those with higher legal status. Obvious historical examples include the overseas Chinese in Southeast Asia, the Jews in Eastern Europe, and non-Muslims in general in the Ottoman Empire. Law and order must be contrasted not only with anarchy or with military insecurity, but also with a regime of arbitrary power, whether expressed in the extortions of individual officials or the unbridled confiscations of government. Pervasively corrupt or arbitrary governments inhibit economic development as much as a lawless frontier. It was only after the Romans established law and order over large parts of Britain that commerce and industry flourished there. It was only after modern imperialist powers established law and order over large areas of Southeast Asia that vast numbers of people from China and India migrated there, contributing to the economic development of the region. Law and order directly foster investment. Britain's pioneering role as the first industrial nation was greatly facilitated by its ability to raise large amounts of capital cheaply, under stable laws securing property. People were willing to invest their savings in long-term ventures, including those which built railroads, canals, and other infrastructure, at very low rates of return, because, first, those returns were protected by property law, and, second, the stability of the currency meant that even modest rates of return would not be wiped out by inflation. By contrast, countries in which investments are jeopardized by the extortions of officials and the confiscations, nationalization, of government, find it difficult to attract needed capital, either from their own people or from foreign investors, except for projects having high and quick returns. In turn, these high and quick returns to foreigners are likely to provoke a political hostility to exploitation, which inhibits the inflow of longer-term investments in sufficient quantities to allow competition to reduce profit rates to more modest levels. The huge investments of international capital, which helped spread the Industrial Revolution throughout the world, went primarily to countries where law and order were already established, such as the nations of Europe or European offshoot societies, like those of North America, Australia, or South Africa. These massive investments dwarfed European investments in those less developed regions of the world, where law and order were less firmly established, either by indigenous rulers or by colonial powers. Just as the establishing of law and order facilitates investment, so the mere threat of a breakdown in one aspect of law and order, property rights, for example, can send capital fleeing the country. When anti-Asian sentiment surfaced as Kenya approached its transition from colony to independent nation in the middle of the 20th century, Asian capital was sent abroad in large amounts, not to India or Pakistan, but to London. Capital is cosmopolitan. In many countries, perhaps most countries, the establishment of law and order over large regions was a long and arduous process. Yet those who today advocate that government's economic role is to preserve the essential framework of law and order, leaving more specific economic decisions to the marketplace, are accused of saying that government should do nothing, even though, one, it took centuries to accomplish what is today called nothing, and two, that nothing has brought widespread economic benefits to great numbers of human beings. The economic importance of law and order is demonstrated not only by the differing facility of attracting capital and immigration into areas where it is less established or better established, but also by comparisons of the economic performances of different groups in the same society, when unusual circumstances cause some groups to be more subject to a reliable framework of law and order than are other groups. A militarily powerful nation may, for example, obtain unilateral extraterritoriality privileges for its citizens operating in a weaker foreign country. These citizens of the more powerful country then carry on their economic activities within their own framework of law and order, unhindered by the caprices or extortions of local authorities, who may continue to stifle the economic activities of the local people. While the special extraterritoriality of diplomatic personnel is widely accepted as a reciprocal arrangement between nations, the unilateral imposition of extraterritoriality for one country's nationals operating in another country has been bitterly resented as humiliating infringements of sovereignty. However, the Ottoman Turks, after their historic conquest of Constantinople established their empire, voluntarily extended extraterritoriality to selected countries who were in no position to impose such a demand on them. This clearly suggests that there can be benefits to the host country in such special arrangements for law and order. More international trade and investment can be attracted when foreign traders and investors are shielded from the uncertainties, inefficiencies, caprices, extortions, or confiscations of local authorities. In later centuries, during the declining phase of the Ottoman Empire as an international power, more and more European powers sought a special legal status, not only for their own respective nationals operating on Ottoman territory, but also for Ottoman subjects operating as agents for European governments or businesses. These agents were typically Christians, notably Armenians and Greeks, or Jews, rather than the Muslims who made up a majority of the empire's subjects. While these privileges conferred an advantage on foreign economic enterprises and domestic ethnic minorities competing with the majority of Ottoman subjects, this arrangement was not simply a zero-sum transfer of benefits. Much of the economic development of the empire's modern sectors was the work of these foreigners and domestic minorities, who had the benefit of a more reliable framework of law and order. The Ottoman Empire was not unique in voluntarily extending to foreigners the right to live within its borders under their own laws. German farmers were encouraged to settle in other Central European nations in the 18th century by being allowed to live under their own laws and customs in these new lands, which sought the advantage of the more advanced German farming methods. Those who focus on the justice or injustice of a given law and order, especially as regards racial and ethnic minorities, sometimes regard the undermining of that law and order as beneficial to oppressed groups. Yet, as law and order become less effective, often the least fortunate suffer more than others from its breakdown. In a city where crime is rampant, the poor suffer not only the full brunt of its physical dangers, but also the indirect costs of higher prices in neighborhoods plagued by theft and vandalism. More fortunate groups can live in buildings with security systems and security personnel, and in neighborhoods located strategically away from the worst areas. Historically, the lawlessness of a frontier society, the collapse of an empire, or the disruption of civil government by the vagaries of warfare have all unleashed violence against vulnerable minorities. The Chinese were victims of such mob violence during the vigilante era in San Francisco and during the interregnum between the withdrawal of Japanese forces from Indonesia after World War II and the re-establishment of Dutch rule. The Volga Germans became targets of violence and looting by their neighbors during the anarchic period when red and white armies contended for supremacy after the Bolshevik Revolution. Jews suffered repeatedly from the breakdown of law and order in medieval Europe. The great increase in violent crime in the United States that began in the 1960s claimed a disproportionate number of black victims, with more blacks than whites being murdered in some years, even though blacks had been less than one-eighth of the population of the country. Democracy. The apparently simple concept of democracy, majority rule, becomes not only complicated but confused when various desirable goals such as freedom, equality, or the dignity of the individual are made part of the definition of democracy. Whether majority rule will in fact lead toward such things is an empirical question rather than a foregone conclusion. A painfully large amount of evidence indicates that majority rule can lead in the opposite direction, especially in multiracial or multi-ethnic societies. It does not inevitably or invariably do so, but the extent to which democracy promotes or negates these goals, and the conditions under which it has one effect rather than the opposite, are questions that need investigating. Settling the matter by definition preempts such an investigation. In numerous colonial nations which emerged into independence after World War II, racial, ethnic, and religious minorities were unenthusiastic about independence, if not positively opposed to it, because they foresaw that majority rule would mean a trampling on their rights. The Karens in Burma, Africans in Zanzibar, Muslims in the Philippines, Chinese in Indonesia, Maronites in Lebanon, and Tamils in Sri Lanka were only some of the minorities with such fears, all too often justified, as subsequent events proved. For such groups, democracy did not mean freedom, equality, or the dignity of the individual. It was precisely their concerns over the prospective loss of such things that led them to prefer living under autocratic colonial rule. Analogously, the role of semi-colonial state governments, supported by the bayonets of an occupying army, provided more protection of the rights of American blacks in the immediate post-Civil War South than this minority was to have when such governments were later superseded by governments more democratically elected and more broadly representative of the white Southern majority. It was precisely these latter Southern governments which instituted pervasive segregation and legalized discrimination, as well as devising new means of political disfranchisement, and which tolerated extra-legal vigilante violence, including widespread lynchings of blacks. Democracy is, of course, also capable of protecting the rights of minorities, or even of making special provisions for their advancement. In the second half of the 20th century, such roles were assumed by democratic governments in the United States, New Zealand, Israel, India, Britain, and Canada, for example. Political parties representing ethnic coalitions also attempt to mute intergroup conflicts and moderate differences. The Alliance Party in Malaysia in the late 20th century and the multi-ethnic political machines in American cities during the European immigrant era being examples of this. Democracy alone, however, is not enough to indicate which way political action and governmental policy will affect racial and ethnic groups. For that, it is necessary to look more closely at the nature of political parties, or of military forces, or sometimes the political actions of various groups' countries of origin. Political parties. Political parties in ethnically diverse societies may play either a moderating or a polarizing role, depending upon the nature of the political competition. In democratic political systems, with all groups franchised and none able to organize a majority on purely ethnic issues, the competition to maximize electoral support requires mollifying the various ethnic groups, and where egalitarian principles or fear of national divisiveness are widespread concerns among the electorate at large, observing at least outward decencies, even toward ethnic groups that vote overwhelmingly for an opposing party. In the United States, for example, the fact that most Jews vote for liberal Democrats does not mean that the Republican Party can run for office on an anti-Semitic platform, which would repel Gentile voters as well as Jews, and Republican voters as well as Democrats. No Republican politician can proclaim himself a champion of Gentiles in the way in which a politician in Sri Lanka can proclaim himself a champion of the Sinhalese, or a politician in Trinidad or Guyana can proclaim himself a champion of the Indians. Nor is this merely a matter of personal conviction, morality, or ideology. Politicians in all these countries are preoccupied with getting elected. The differences must be explained in terms of the political conditions which promote moderation and those that promote polarization. For ethnic polarization to be a politically viable and attractive policy for office seekers, it is not sufficient that particular groups vote overwhelmingly for one party while other groups vote overwhelmingly for another party. If ideology, economic self-interest, candidate charisma, party loyalty, and other such considerations provide the basis for a substantial proportion of the votes, then the parties are not ethnic parties, whatever the ethnic composition of their voters. The emergence of ethnic political parties, as in Nigeria, Sri Lanka, Trinidad, or Guyana, requires not only that particular groups give their voting support to particular parties, but also that, one, those parties are dependent for their voting support almost exclusively on an ethnically defined constituency, that, two, their chances of gaining significant political support outside that ethnic constituency are virtually nil, and that, three, open appeals to ethnicity, including explicit antagonism to other groups, does not cost them votes within their existing constituency or in the general population. All these are different ways of expressing the same condition, that major ethnic political parties are viable only where ethnic issues have already superseded class, ideological, charismatic, and other considerations, and where offending one group does not offend others outside that group. In short, such a society already exhibits ethnic factionalism. The question here is whether political parties moderate or accentuate existing antagonisms under these conditions. Without all three prerequisites for a truly ethnic party, the tendency of political competition is to moderate rather than to accentuate existing ethnic conflicts. The percentage of Black Americans who voted for Democratic Party presidential candidates during the 1980s was similar to the overwhelming vote of particular ethnic groups for particular parties in Trinidad, Guyana, Ghana, Nigeria, and the Congo Republic. But this did not make American political parties ethnic. Only the ability to gain political control of the government with an appeal on ethnic grounds to one ethnic group alone makes increased ethnic polarization a viable policy for politicians. Whether or not polarization promotes the long-run viability of the country is another question entirely, and one often ignored by those seeking office and power. The gaining of control of government power in South Africa by the Afrikaner-dominated Nationalist Party in 1948 did not merely reflect existing racial and ethnic divisions, but significantly added to them through apartheid policies. Similarly, the gaining of regional political power on an explicitly racial basis by whites in the southern United States after the Reconstruction era not only reflected but accentuated racism through Jim Crow laws. Whites were, of course, just as politically dominant in the rest of the United States, but the fact that that dominance was organized along ideological, economic, and other lines meant that there was no racial or ethnic party as such in the North, and therefore no comparable incentives to exacerbate existing racial or ethnic conflicts. On the contrary, the role of American political parties representing multi-ethnic constituencies has historically been to mollify, reconcile, or at least paper over ethnic conflicts. For decades, the same political party, the Democrats, played this moderating role in the North while playing a polarizing role in the South. There were both racial and ethnic conflicts outside the South, but none of the ethnic groups was large enough to produce an electoral majority. And while whites as a whole were a clear racial majority, the relatively small black population of the North was not of sufficient concern to make racial politics preemptive over class, ideological, economic, and other issues. Thus, the United States outside the South developed a two-party system with multi-ethnic parties, while in the South, a single race-based party, the Democrats, reigned supreme from before the Civil War until well after World War II. The coexistence of these diametrically opposite political tendencies in different regions of the same country at the same time and in the same national party highlights the different effects of ethnically organized political parties and of political parties organized on various other non-ethnic bases, even when the actual racial composition of the two kinds of party voters and leaders is quite similar. Even more dramatic examples of the difference between ethnic and multi-ethnic parties and their effects on existing racial or ethnic conflicts can be found in the post-independence history of Sri Lanka and Malaysia. Initially, at independence, relations between the Sinhalese and the Tamils in Sri Lanka were nowhere near as hostile as those between the Malays and the Chinese in Malaysia, where a long civil war pitted Chinese communist guerrillas against Malay troops and Malay villagers. Yet, over the years, the Malaysian multi-ethnic coalition government has generally managed to moderate potentially explosive resentments. By contrast, the relative amicability of relations between the Sinhalese and the Tamils at the time of national independence has been turned into ever more bitter hostility by ethnic political parties outbidding each other for the support of one group or the other, with moderates on both sides being forced to ever more extreme positions by rivals for the same ethnic votes. The transition from the initial condition of mutual tolerance in Sri Lanka to the threshold level of group antagonism necessary to create ethnic issue parties was produced in a few years by the skilled political demagoguery of Sinhalese political leader SWRD Bandaranaike as part of his campaign to become prime minister in 1956. Once ethnic issues became preemptive for parties of all ideological leanings, ever more extreme demands from both the Sinhalese and the Tamils followed. Moreover, this political polarization has in turn increased cultural polarization, even among the cosmopolitan elements of both groups. Whereas highly educated Sinhalese or Tamils once spoke English in their homes and spoke their respective group languages only to servants or other lower class people, that changed after political polarization. Persons in these strata today, although English remains their first language, can read and write Sinhala or Tamil, increasingly speak to their children in one of those languages, and generally are educating their children in the Sinhala or Tamil medium. In short, the highly educated cosmopolitan elements of both Sri Lankan groups, once looked to hopefully as a bridge between the two communities, in part because they literally spoke the same language, have themselves joined in the general polarization, now cultural as well as political. While this has been characterized as a triumph of primordial identification and loyalty over the new identifications based on class, urbanization, and westernization, it was in fact a product of a set of political incentives which has produced the same result in both Western and non-Western societies alike. Although the threshold level of group antagonism necessary for ethnic issue parties can be produced by a single political demagogue, The logic of ethnic issue competition then acquires a life of its own, independent of the demagogue who initiated it. In the case of Sri Lanka, Bandaranaike's attempt to diffuse ethnic tensions, after they had served his purpose by gaining him the prime ministership, led only to his being assassinated by one of the extremists on his side. Racial or ethnic polarization is not a readily reversible process once the prerequisites for ethnic issue parties have been created. In some countries, such as Kenya and Zambia, the political polarization process was ended only by establishing one-party authoritarian government. Malaysia dampened ethnic politics by making it a crime to question publicly the government's ethnic policy. Nigeria recovered from an even more bitter and bloody civil war than that in Malaysia, changing its political system to require national electoral support for its president, which meant multi-ethnic support in a country whose various regions were dominated by different groups. While Nigeria continued to have strong ethnic voting patterns, the new policies did achieve the desired effect of de-escalating ethnic tensions, which had been at literally murderous levels, in direct contrast to the opposite trend created by oppositional political incentives in Sri Lanka. Even minority politicians with no real hope of achieving national power have every incentive to contribute to polarization, despite the fact that their outnumbered people will probably end up the losers if their opponents have already made ethnicity an overriding issue. In such an atmosphere, the individual career prospects of the minority politician are enhanced as he assumes the role of defender of his beleaguered people. Not everyone chooses to join in polarization, but the systemic effect may be the same as if they did. Parties and individuals ideologically opposed to ethnic polarization have suffered devastating political losses in such circumstances, in Sri Lanka, Guyana, and Trinidad, for example, leading some to do abrupt about-faces in order to save their political careers. Others have simply disappeared from the political scene for lack of electoral support. In the American South, during the era of one-party racial politics, there was no racial minority political party because Negroes were disfranchised. The erosion of racism within the region and the national imposition of voting rights for Black Americans in the 1960s combined to destroy very rapidly the one-race, one-party system that had persisted in the region for more than a century. Given that whites were still a substantial majority in most southern states, enfranchisement alone would have been insufficient to end racial polarization politics. Enfranchisement could simply have allowed Black minority parties to emerge and to coexist alongside the white majority party, as single group majority and minority parties exist in Sri Lanka, Trinidad, Guyana, and other places. Had race remained preemptive over all other political issues combined, for virtually the entire white population of the South, such a situation would have been politically viable in the region, with all the continuing potential for escalating polarization. What was necessary to break the back of the old racial politics of the South was at least a substantial minority of white voters responsive to other issues, including racial peace, to split the white vote, and so make it politically impossible for any party to antagonize the entire Black electorate and expect to win. This was, in fact, the political situation in the South in the wake of the enfranchisement of Blacks. Two-party politics with biracial appeals spread rapidly through the South, with the strident white supremacy rhetoric of more than a century suddenly becoming taboo. Again, politics did not simply reflect public opinion. Under these circumstances, the incentives created by multi-ethnic, multi-party politics ran ahead of public opinion in moderating group antagonisms, just as single-party, single-race politics had exacerbated these antagonisms in the region for generations. The abruptness of the political change exceeded any likely pace of change in public opinion. In politics, as in economics, there does not need to be an end to all racism for the effective power of racism to be broken. Competition is the crucial factor in both the economic and the political system. In short, the rise of ethnic political parties, or the transformation of existing multi-ethnic, ideological, or interest group parties into ethnic parties, is not only a response to ethnic divisiveness, but also contributes to it, turning divisiveness into polarization. Conversely, competition among non-ethnic parties has a moderating effect, as each party tries to entice additional voters from those beyond its own core supporters. In non-ethnic two-party systems, such as those in the United States, Britain, or Australia, both parties may crowd toward the center of the political spectrum in an attempt to compete for uncommitted votes. By contrast, ethnic political parties, as in Ghana, Sri Lanka, Trinidad, Guyana, or the Punjab, cannot compete effectively for voters beyond their own ethnic boundaries, and so have little incentive to moderate their ethnic claims and much reason to maximize their image of uncompromising dedication to the most sweeping forms of such claims. Even in situations where some groups have no political party because they are disfranchised, blacks in South Africa during the era of white minority rule, for example, political incentives can still have effects. Among the incentives to political moderation among disfranchised groups is the hope of gaining concrete concessions, even of a limited sort, which political moderates may then exhibit as trophies of their success, and therefore as reasons for their constituency to support them in their approach. But in situations where moderate demands are no more likely to be met than extreme demands, the extremists have the advantage of being able to politically outbid the moderates in rhetoric, without the corresponding disadvantage of being less able to deliver. In the early days of the African National Congress in South Africa, for example, the ANC demands were very moderate, but the refusal of the ruling whites to make even minor concessions enabled more militant and extreme elements to replace the moderates in the leadership of the ANC over the years. By contrast, the very moderate leadership of Booker T. Washington was more successful in the United States, at least in the political sense that his approach retained the support of an important constituency, whether or not a majority, within the black population until his death and even beyond. Washington and his supporters could point to the fact that he was able to deliver, in terms of white financial support for the development of Tuskegee Institute and other social ventures, even though Southern blacks remained during his lifetime almost as completely disfranchised as blacks in South Africa. The original leaders of the African National Congress in South Africa were, in fact, conscious followers of Booker T. Washington, but his strategy failed politically there because South African whites were more intransigent, leading to a black leadership in South Africa that ultimately became much more extreme than the leadership of American blacks. Some observers have regarded the original demands of the ANC, such as token representation of blacks in the political councils of the nation, as demands quite acceptable to most South African whites by the 1980s. But, of course, these were no longer the ANC demands by then, in part because of the political incentives created by the unresponsiveness of an earlier generation of whites. Military politics. Military forces are seldom ethnically representative of their respective societies. At one time, half the officers in the Malaysian Air Force were Chinese, and only one-third were Malay, just the reverse of their proportions in the population of the country. More than half the non-commissioned officers in the Soviet military were Ukrainians. It has been common in many African and Asian states for minority ethnic groups to form a majority of the armed forces or of the officer corps. Whether these ethnic disparities represent conscious policies or the consequences of social patterns, they often have political implications, especially in newly established states vulnerable to military coups. However, ethnically motivated intrusions of the military into civilian politics is often preceded by ethnically motivated intrusions of civilian politicians into the internal military chain of command. Ethnic polarization and military politics have made an explosive mixture in countries around the world. Just as political careers are relatively more attractive to groups with less favorable economic alternatives, so are military careers in the lower ranks. Accordingly, in many colonial countries, the less modernized of the indigenous peoples, often from rural hinterlands, have supplied a disproportionate share of the ordinary soldiers in the colonial armies. This pattern existed in colonial Burma, Iraq, Nigeria, Somalia, and Indonesia, among other places. Where the colonial power was deliberately selective on an ethnic basis, the groups sought for military service were often those noted for martial qualities, combined with political reliability, the Sikhs and Gurkhas in India being examples of such deliberate recruitment. When colonial peoples were eventually allowed into the commissioned officer corps, often very different ethnic groups supplied officers than those which supplied the enlisted soldiers. This was especially so when becoming a commissioned officer required education at military academies, rather than promotion from the ranks. An educated officer corps has tended to draw upon the more modernized indigenous ethnic groups, whereas the enlisted men have come from more traditional ethnic or tribal regions. Thus, while the enlisted ranks of the Nigerian colonial army had a substantial majority of Hausa riflemen, more than half of its first African commissioned officers were Igbos. In Ceylon, Ghana, and Iraq, Indigenous officers were trained at European military academies. But where officers were primarily promoted from the ranks, as in Kenya or Togo, their ethnicity was, of course, that of the enlisted ranks, which is not, however, to say that it was that of the general population. In colonies where both methods of commissioning officers were used, as in Uganda or Guinea, the officers promoted from the ranks were ethnically different from those commissioned out of military academies. The change from colonial status to national independence has also often affected the ethnic makeup of the military, where the ethnic composition of the military, and especially of the military officers, has differed greatly from the ethnic composition of the ruling civilian politicians. Ethnic polarization in the society has often led to political intervention designed to change the ethnic composition of the military, or to military intervention designed to change the ethnic composition of the civilian government, or to both. Ghana, Uganda, and Libya are examples of mutual interference of this sort. Election results in ethnically polarized societies have been reversed by military coups when the ethnic group achieving political power through the ballot was hostile to the ethnic group in charge of the military, as in Sierra Leone or in Fiji. But military power, with or without coups, has put ethnic minorities in political power from Uganda to Suriname. The suspicions and threats inherent in polarized societies with civilian and military power centered in opposing ethnic groups often make it nearly impossible for the line of demarcation between military and political institutions to be respected and maintained. Political attempts to forestall coups have included ethnic favoritism in military recruiting and promotion, sometimes extending to purges of military officers for political reasons, and sometimes assignment of top officers to either sensitive or inconsequential command posts according to their ethnicity, and therefore presumed loyalties. This political violation of the integrity of the military in turn generates hostility even among non-political career officers, and may itself promote or precipitate a coup. But failure to take such precautions against a coup can also be disastrous. In short, ethnic polarization creates military as well as political and social tensions that may often be virtually impossible to resolve. In some situations, where there is an external threat felt by all, the military can become a source of moderation of ethnic tensions. Men of different ethnic backgrounds, living side by side on a daily basis in military units, and in some cases being dependent upon each other for safeguarding one another's lives, often develop a better trust and understanding than they would have had in civilian life, where they lived in separate enclaves or in different social strata. The role of Irish soldiers in the British Army in two world wars helped ease ethnic differences in the post-war eras. The exemplary military record of Japanese-American fighting units during World War II caused a virtually overnight change in other Americans' attitudes toward them. The role of the Middle Eastern and North African Jews in defending Israel against military attack likewise helped bridge the gap between them and the European and American Jews in Israel. Where the external enemy is of the same race or ethnicity as one of the internal ethnic minorities, however, that group may well suffer from the animosities generated in warfare. Germans in Russia, Australia, and Brazil, for example, suffered from Germany's warfare against these countries during both world wars. But this is not inevitable. In the United States, the anti-German feelings of the First World War were not repeated in the Second, and hostile feelings against Japanese Americans were very quickly turned around by their own proofs of patriotism at home and abroad. As an organization with a vital mission and a powerful set of traditions and codes of its own, the military can in many cases moderate ethnicity by its own overriding imperatives involving life and death. But the ability of strong ethnic feelings to endanger the military's role and effectiveness has led numerous nations to segregate different groups serving on military duty, whether in peace or war. Some ethnically segregated units existed in the American military from the Revolutionary War to the Civil War. Germans, for example, serving in German-speaking units, and racially segregated units were common as late as World War II. Imperial armies in the era of European colonialism often assigned segregated troops far from their local areas, whether in the colony or abroad, and the Soviet military continued this practice. No single outcome can be predicted from the complex interaction of ethnicity, polarized politics, and the military, but many coups and much bloodshed indicate that all are powerful forces whose clashes can be catastrophic. But while military coups have been a way of life in parts of Latin America and in many third world countries emerging into national independence since World War II, The threat of military coups has long been remote in northwestern European nations and in their offshoot societies around the world, such as the United States or Australia. Perhaps it is the exemption of these latter nations from military intervention in civilian government which requires explanation, rather than the susceptibility of so many other nations to it. As in other fields, the mere copying of the institution of stable societies cannot create the historically evolved traditions and attitudes that make those institutions work. Homeland politics. The relationship between an ethnic minority community and its foreign homeland can produce a variety of political patterns. These have varied from group to group and from time to time and place to place with a given group. Homeland politics include 1. Efforts of a particular ethnic group to have its country of residence and citizenship adopt more favorable policies toward the ancestral homeland. 2. Efforts of the homeland to get another country to adopt more favorable policies toward emigrants from the homeland and their descendants. And 3. Homeland efforts to use its compatriots in other countries to advance its own national self-interest. The relationship between cultural ties and political ties with a homeland is by no means simple and direct. Italians, for example, have tended to retain some cultural patterns from Italy, even after living for generations in other countries, but they have seldom exerted much political pressure for their respective countries of residence to behave more favorably toward Italy. Likewise, Germans in Tsarist Russia were, for generations, a highly separate and self-conscious enclave of German culture, while loyally serving the Russian Empire, even during the war against Germany in 1914-17. However, during the Second World War, hundreds of thousands of Germans defected from the Soviet Union to follow the German armies in retreat. Years of brutal treatment by Soviet authorities had much to do with the change. As far back as the 19th century, organizations within Germany attempted to maintain ties and wield influence with Germans in foreign lands, with and without the help of the German government. But Germans in Bohemia and in the Baltic long maintained their local political loyalties and were cosmopolitan in their willingness to welcome rising indigenous individuals into the dominant German culture. Yet the emergence of indigenous Czech chauvinism ultimately provoked German counter-chauvinism. In Czechoslovakia, the Germans in the Sudetenland became the focal point of an international crisis in 1938 that led to the dismemberment of the Czech state. German governments have used, or attempted to use, Germans in other countries as instruments of national foreign policy, even before the rise of Hitler and the Nazis. These efforts have repeatedly operated to the detriment of German communities in other lands, such as Australia, Brazil, or the United States, all countries where nativist backlashes were particularly strong during the First World War. International ethnic politics need not originate in the ancestral homeland or involve the homeland at all. For centuries, Jews in various countries have attempted to help one another, even when there was no ancient or modern state of Israel. Mennonites have likewise maintained international ties with one another, unrelated to national governments. In the later and declining Ottoman Empire, various European governments assumed a protective role toward various Ottoman minorities who were neither citizens nor descendants of citizens of these particular European powers. These were typically Christian minorities. Russia, for example, assumed a protective role toward members of the Orthodox religion, France was protective toward Catholics, and Britain and Prussia toward Protestants. On an individual basis, members of these and other groups, including Jews, might be extended diplomatic status by one of these protective governments for whom they were working in one capacity or another, or were affiliated with as trading partners. Many of the phenomena associated with homeland politics appeared in these relationships, notably divided loyalties by the protégés and a hostility toward them by the surrounding populace during periods of strife or tension with their foreign protectors. Just as an ancestral link to a foreign country is not essential for some of the social and political phenomena associated with homeland politics, so the foreign link need not be a government. The Missouri Synod of the Lutheran Church in the United States has operated as an independent center of influence on German communities in other countries, competing with Lutheran organizations from Germany in intellectual and financial support for affiliated religious bodies and their schools abroad. In Brazil and Australia, for example, Lutheran organizations affiliated with American and German organizations differed in their respective responses to Germany's military aggressions in Europe. The maintenance of a homeland culture in foreign countries is neither a necessary nor a sufficient basis for political ties with the country of origin. Irish Americans have long been thoroughly acculturated in the United States, differing in no essential way from the general American population, economically, socially, or politically. Yet Irish Americans have also long been a major source of the financial support that has kept the violence going in Ulster County. Jewish Americans have likewise become thoroughly Americanized, and yet they are the crucial source of the financial and political support from the United States that makes Israel a viable nation in the Middle East. Black American voters have been, to a lesser extent, a factor in American foreign policy toward African nations in general, and South Africa in particular. Yet cultural affinities between Afro-Americans and Africans are tenuous at best. The homeland can, in some cases, be a source of protection for their ethnic offshoots in other lands. Successive governments in China, under both the Kuomintang and the Communists, have asserted some form of protection for the overseas Chinese, though with highly questionable effectiveness in many cases, especially prior to World War II. During the same era, a more powerful Japan was much more effective in championing the cause of Japanese living overseas. The United States, for example, peremptorily cut off all immigration from China in 1882, leaving vast numbers of Chinese men stranded in the United States without their wives and children, often eking out pathetic existences in isolation for the rest of their lives. Japanese immigrants were spared this fate because of the military power of Japan, which could not be insulted with such impunity. The face-saving Gentlemen's Agreement, arranged between the United States and Japan, meant that Japanese families could be reunited in America, or new brides brought over to join husbands they had married by proxy, while Japan itself stopped further emigration to the U.S. Japan took an active interest in overseas Japanese communities throughout the Western Hemisphere, not only negotiating government-to-government agreements regarding them, but also in some cases actively participating in the creation of Japanese colonies in other countries. In Asia, overseas Japanese became sources of military intelligence, useful to Japan in its lightning conquests in the region following destruction of the American fleet at Pearl Harbor. While the reaction to potential Japanese espionage and sabotage threats was extreme in the United States, Canada, and Peru, such potential threats were not imaginary. Government officials in the United States would have needed to know much more about the cultural history of Japanese Americans than they did to realize that they were a group very loyal to the United States, in contrast to the Japanese in Brazil, who remained fiercely pro-Japan throughout the Second World War. Remittances to the homeland from abroad have also, in some cases, been major economic factors within the homeland, or in its international balance of payments with other nations. Remittances of Chinese Americans made the localities of their origins in China notably more prosperous. Similarly, remittances from Japanese Americans contributed to the development of Hiroshima, with the ironic and tragic result of making it a prime military target in World War II. By the late 20th century, remittances from Asian workers in oil-rich Middle East nations were similarly substantial contributors to the economic well-being of their families back home, and in some cases, to their homeland's international balance of payments. While the homeland may, in some cases, help a branch of its people in a foreign country, often it will not even attempt to do so, when that would conflict with some other foreign policy objective. Despite the gruesome horrors perpetrated against the overseas Chinese, among others, under the Pol Pot regime in Kampuchea, China not only failed to protest publicly, but remained an ally of the Kampuchean regime as part of its foreign policy strategy of building regional alliances to offset the power of the Soviet Union and the United States in Asia. Yet, under much less horrible conditions, the Chinese government dispatched ships to Indonesia to take Chinese refugees back to China after anti-Chinese riots in Indonesia, and opened its borders to many refugees from Vietnam at the time of the Boat People exodus. In both the latter cases, China's government was already at odds with the governments concerned over other issues, and used the plight of the overseas Chinese in these countries as part of its propaganda campaign. During the British colonial era in India, the Indian government often interested itself in the vicissitudes of Indians, especially Indian coolie labor in foreign countries, publicly protesting, negotiating with other governments for better treatment of the Indians, or forbidding emigration from India to countries where conditions were deemed unsatisfactory. Nor was the colonial government in India deterred by the fact that the offending recipient country was almost invariably another member of the British Empire. Yet, ironically, after India became an independent nation, the Indian government has been far less assertive in such matters. The foreign policy of India in the post-independence era has been directed toward achieving international stature as a leader among non-aligned third world nations, and these have often been nations in which overseas Indians were oppressed or persecuted. In 1953, Indian Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru told the overseas Indians in Africa that they were guests of the Africans, and if they do not want you, out you will have to go, bag and baggage. Such prior acquiescence in the expulsions of people born and living in a country for generations was perhaps unique for any government. Certainly it did nothing to discourage African nations from forcing out native-born guests of Indian ancestry. In the most flagrant case, the summary expulsion of 50,000 Indians and Pakistanis from Uganda, stripped of their property and virtually destitute, it was the British rather than the Indian government which led the protests and pressured the Amin regime to moderate its brutal policies. In the case of discrimination against Indians in South Africa during the era of white minority rule, however, the government of India tried to intervene, even though India had been quiescent when there was much worse treatment of Indians in third world countries. By contrast, Israel has interested itself in the fate of Jews in foreign countries, even when these were Jews whose diaspora long antedated creation of the present Israeli state, and even when they were of a race never before resident in Israel, ancient or modern, such as Ethiopian Jews. The worldwide solidarity of Jews promoted by the Holocaust makes it politically impossible for the Israeli government to treat Jews in other countries as expendable, as so many other nations do their foreign offshoots, even for relatively modest foreign policy objectives. Social effects. If political institutions are inherently constrained in what results they can produce, political ideologies are not constrained in what they can promise. To maintain the plausibility of what they promise, however, they must first establish and then maintain a particular vision of social processes that will define a solution within the scope of political action. Whatever the real complex of social forces at work or the relative weights of various factors creating social difficulties for a particular group, political leaders tend to emphasize, sometimes exclusively, those factors for which a law or a government policy can be formulated and those factors which lend themselves to the moral condemnation of other groups. Factors such as intergroup differences in demographic characteristics, geographical distribution, skill levels, or cultural values tend to be ignored, however demonstrably important they may be in a cause and effect sense. Thus, while the black population in late 20th century America suffered greatly from soaring rates of violent crime, from having much of its newborn generation raised by teenage mothers, and from widespread drug addiction, its political leaders have focused their efforts on correcting the failings, real and presumed, of the white population, racism, discrimination, and the like. Programs to reduce white people's wrongdoing have been not only more psychically and politically acceptable among black leaders, the correction of such wrongdoing can more plausibly be represented as being within the effective scope of government. This is wholly different from saying that investments of time and effort in this direction will more effectively raise the level of well-being among black Americans. The attempt to project a group's ills or embarrassments onto other groups takes many forms. Even where other groups have created much of the economic development of a whole society, Indians in Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania, the Chinese in Southeast Asia, non-Hispanic immigrants in Latin America, they have often been politically condemned for allegedly lowering the economic conditions of others through exploitation, the sending of wealth back to their homelands, or by other means. Their role in raising the economic level of the whole society tends to be ignored or downplayed politically, while they are depicted as appropriating a disproportionate share of the wealth that existed somehow. The widespread prevalence of this political pattern in highly disparate societies suggests common incentives rather than common cultural responses. Symbolism. Political solutions are often long on immediate symbolism and short on lasting results. This has happened too often in too many parts of the world to be accidental or mere failures of particular leaders. By its very nature, politics cannot create the skills, attitudes, and habits required for lasting economic achievement. What it can create instead are the tokens and symbols of such achievement. For example, politics cannot cause India's Assamese people to overtake its Bengalis or Marawis in work habits, skills, initiative, or entrepreneurship, nor was that what the Assamese demanded. The Assamese increasingly demanded that Bengalis acknowledge the exclusive legitimacy of Assamese symbols in public life, not only the Assamese language, but Assamese cultural holidays, Assamese historic heroes, and recognition of the great events in Assamese history. These were not mere pious hopes. Violence, arson, and looting have backed up such demands on numerous occasions. When a university in Assam allowed Bengali students to take examinations in their own language in 1972, riots erupted in many towns in Assam, and troops had to be called out to restore order. Symbolic demands for cultural obeisance have been prominent in Indonesia as well. Pressure on the Chinese to change their names to Indonesian names, and bans on such innocuous Chinese cultural manifestations as the colorful dragon processions, which are common in many Chinese communities in other lands, exemplify a demand for politically imposed cultural victories over people whose economic achievements cannot be matched within any time period that is politically relevant. French separatists in Quebec have likewise made language and culture explosive issues in more than the figurative sense. Bombs were often their means of communicating frustration and anger against the more prosperous English-speaking Canadians. Pierre Trudeau emerged in Canada's Quebec province in the 1960s crying French power and having no substantive policy other than bilingualism and biculturalism. He exemplified the symbolic substitute for economic achievements among a people historically less successful in the world in which they lived. Preoccupation with political symbolism may be unlikely to produce either substantive achievement or the respect which such achievement brings, but if substantive advances are in fact achievable only after long enough time for major transformations of a whole people's productivity, then symbols, trinkets, and tokens may be all that are possible within a time horizon that is politically relevant. Group polarization patterns. Political anger and demands for privileges are, of course, not limited to the less privileged. Indeed, even when demands are made in the name of less privileged racial or ethnic groups, often it is the more privileged members of such groups who make the demands and who benefit from policies designed to meet such demands. These demands may erupt suddenly in the wake of the creation or sharp enlargement of a newly educated class, which sees its path to coveted middle-class professions blocked by the competition of other groups, as in India, French Canada, or Lithuania, for example. While it is politically easier for the advantaged to seek further advantages in the name of the disadvantaged, they can also do so without such disguise, where they have sufficient political cohesion to make their raw power felt. Afrikaners in South Africa and Southern whites in the United States are extreme examples of a process in which nationalism, race, or religion is among the rallying cries around which to claim political privilege. Sharp group differences in race, culture, or history may or may not exist in these political struggles. Such differences will be utilized politically when they do exist, but where the differences are small and even trivial to an outsider, they will simply be magnified for political purposes. India provides a number of examples of this, as a scholarly study has noted. The nativist movement in Bombay opposes Tamil migrants, but pays little attention to the more numerous Telugu-speaking migrants, though both are equally alien people from the south. The local population of the city of Hyderabad is hostile to migrants from the eastern part of the state with whom they share a common language, culture, and religion, but there is little resentment against Marathi, Kannada, and Tamil-speaking migrants from other states, with whom the cultural differences are far more substantial. Similar patterns have existed thousands of miles away in West Africa. An instructive instance is provided by the vocal opposition in the Oyo and Ondo provinces of western Nigeria to the operations of produce buyers from Ijebu Ode. For some years past, Jebu traders from Ijebu Ode have been operating in the neighboring districts of Oyo and Ondo, purchasing cocoa and palm kernels. The Jebus are racially closely related to the population of Oyo and Ondo. Ethnically and linguistically, they are almost identical. Moreover, the Jebus frequently engage local agents and lorry drivers to act on their behalf. These traders have secured supplies by outbidding the local produce buyers, and their activities have aroused opposition, which is led by certain influential Yoruba chiefs. It is clearly unconnected with racial animosity, and is a straightforward attempt by the local produce buyers to curtail competition, which obviously benefits the local farmers. This is a particularly clear-cut example of the economic basis of ostensible xenophobia. Economics is often the key to such anomalies, and the implications reach well beyond India or Nigeria. Those cities in India with strident political nativist movements demanding preferential treatment for local groups have generally been cities where, 1, most of the lower middle class positions were held by outside groups, and where, 2, there were growing numbers of the educated unemployed locally. Such movements tend to be disproportionately staffed by and appeal to those who are part of the first generation of their family to be educated. Ironically, it was such people who made Indians their target and prey in East Africa. A rapid expansion of education is thus a factor in producing intergroup conflict, especially where the education is of a kind which produces diplomas rather than skills that have significant economic value in the marketplace. Education of a sort useful only for being a clerk, bureaucrat, or school teacher, jobs whose numbers are relatively fixed in the short run and politically determined in the long run, tend to increase politicized intergroup strife. Yet newly emerging groups, whether in their own countries or abroad, tend to specialize precisely in such undemanding fields. Malay students, for example, have tended to specialize in Malay studies and Islamic studies, which provide them with no skills with which to compete with the Chinese in the marketplace, either as businessmen, independent professionals, or technicians. Blacks and Hispanics in the United States follow a very similar pattern of specializing disproportionately in easier fields, which offer less in the way of marketable skills. Such groups then have little choice but to turn to the government, not only for jobs, but also for group preferences to be imposed in the marketplace, and for symbolic recognition in various forms. Intergroup competition is, in one sense, inevitable in a world without unlimited resources, but the nature and intensity of this competition may be either moderated or accentuated, depending upon the institutions through which it takes place. The marketplace provides incentives for groups to moderate their competing demands upon the resources and output of the economy, because prices serve as an impersonal mechanism to cause self-rationing. Ethnic politics has just the opposite effect. Although politicians do not create economic benefits, they can transfer them, usually below cost and often free to the recipients. Just as prices force self-rationing, freeness permits self-indulgence. Competing demands readily escalate beyond what is available, without the constraining effect of price to convey the scarcity and production cost of what is demanded. The inherent constraints of economic life are not removed by political intervention. Rationing among individuals and groups is as much an inherent necessity as ever. The rationing must simply be done by other means, such as political struggles, violence, or the threat of violence. Politics is not simply a mechanism for resolving existing differences among racial and ethnic groups. Politics can also generate and magnify such conflicts. Groups with little racial or cultural difference, such as the Undras and the Telanganans in India, may exaggerate what small differences there are in order to compete for political favors as more or less artificially created social groups. Similarly, more or less natural social groups, such as the Italians and Greeks in Australia, may make little or no effort to organize politically until after group-based benefits have been proffered by national political parties. There is no such group as Hispanics anywhere in the world except in the United States, because only in the U.S. do government programs recognize such a category, thereby leading to political ethnic coalitions to capitalize on government grants and appropriations. In short, political favors are not simply responses to existing groups. The groups themselves may be artifacts created by political favors, and even when not created by these favors, their degree of self-consciousness, politicization, or polarization may be functions of the availability of government largesse. However detrimental polarization may prove to be to particular groups, or to the society as a whole, it may still be beneficial to those in official positions at various levels. In Thailand, for example, the abortive attempt to drive the Chinese out of the rice exporting business by establishing a government monopoly did not achieve its goal, but did succeed in diverting profits to Thai soldiers, police officials, and politicians, whose cooperation became necessary to allow the Chinese entrepreneur to continue performing a function which only he could perform. Much the same story of corruption and quasi-corruption could be found in Malaysia and Indonesia. It is not at all uncommon for policies to be simultaneously politically effective and economically counterproductive. In Uganda, the expulsions of the East Indians were so popular that political pressure developed to do the same in neighboring Kenya, even though the economic consequences proved disastrous for Uganda. While economic interests are sometimes significant in explaining political decisions, they are by no means universally valid explanations. Educated elites from less advanced groups may have ample economic incentives to promote polarization and preferential treatment policies. But the real question is, why the uneducated masses from such groups give them the political support without which they would be impotent? Indeed, it is often the less educated masses who unleash the mob violence from which their elite compatriots ultimately benefit, as in Malaysia, Sri Lanka, or parts of India, Africa, or the United States, where such violence has led to group preference policies in employment, educational institutions, and elsewhere. The common denominator in these highly disparate societies seems to be not only resentment of other groups' success, but also fear of an inability to compete with them, combined with a painful embarrassment at being so visibly underrepresented, or missing entirely, in prestigious occupations and institutions. To remedy this within a politically relevant time horizon requires not simply increased opportunities, but earmarked benefits directly given on a racial or ethnic basis. Political leadership. Politics is in large part a merchandising of leadership, not only particular leaders, movements, or parties, but in addition, the general concept of political leadership and its importance. It is not enough to represent oneself as the best leader if, in fact, political leadership makes relatively little difference in many of the things that matter. The implicit agreement of contending leaders that leadership is important is too inherently self-serving to prove very much, but the most diverse political leaders share a common interest in exaggerating the importance of political leadership. Even ethnic minority leaders, with no realistic hope of acquiring decisive national power, have an incentive to join in the general promotion of the leadership concept, as that offers them individually their best chance of gaining whatever political positions may be available to them. If ethnic political leadership were of major importance in economic advancement, then the more prosperous ethnic groups should exhibit higher quality leadership. It is by no means clear that they do. Prominent political leadership has been rare to non-existent among the overseas Chinese in various countries where they rose from poverty to affluence. Such leadership as has emerged has tended to be the opposite of charismatic, to maintain low profiles personally and low profiles for the Chinese as a group. Much the same story could be told of the Jews in many countries over the centuries. Jews in Argentina resented even favorable attention from the political powers, for heightened public awareness of Jews as a group could be dangerous in the long run. Quality and prominence are, of course, very different aspects of leadership, so that little-known leadership might be wise and effective leadership in some circumstances. Even so, it is by no means clear that the leadership of more successful groups has been noticeably or consistently of better quality than the leadership of less fortunate groups. Part of the leadership of the overseas Chinese has historically been Tong leadership. The Tong's clandestine and often criminal activities have generally brought increased resentments and repressions upon the Chinese from the authorities of their respective host societies. Ethnic political leadership has been slow to develop at all among Germans in a number of countries, the most notable exception being during the Nazi era, when such leadership among Germans abroad served largely to bring resentments, and in some cases repressions and violence, upon Germans as a whole. Less successful ethnic groups are often richly endowed with leaders. Any well-informed American can readily name half a dozen black leaders, current or from U.S. history, but would probably have difficulty naming a similar number of Jewish or Japanese American ethnic leaders. Similarly, it is doubtful if they could name as many prominent Italian American ethnic leaders as prominent American Indian chiefs. Irish Americans have historically produced a number of notable ethnic leaders, but more so during their 19th century poverty than during their 20th century rise to prosperity. Group unity. The promotion of group unity has been one aspect of political leadership, but here again, it is doubtful whether economically successful groups have been any more unified than less fortunate groups. Chinese communities in Southeast Asia have historically been fragmented according to their regional origins in China, and even among the small Chinese communities in the Caribbean, the Cantonese have remained residentially and socially separate from the Hakkas. Internal regional, caste, and religious separation among the peoples of India remains significant in overseas nations. Jews are divided into many groups that maintain separate synagogues and separate cemeteries, and have little or no intermarriage with one another. Mutual aid organizations among Italians overseas often run into the hundreds in a given country because Italians from different provinces, or even cities or villages, maintain separate organizations and resist consolidation, even when this would produce better risk spreading for insurance purposes. It is doubtful if internal divisions among American Negroes, for example, have historically been as severe as divisions among more economically successful groups, and certainly not more severe, either socially or politically. The kind of idealized unity projected by political leaders and intellectuals has seldom existed among any racial or ethnic minority anywhere, nor has the economic progress of racial or ethnic groups been much correlated with their closeness to or remoteness from such unity. The very attempt to enforce unity behind a particular political agenda can itself generate greater internal strife than would exist otherwise. Moreover, the history of ideas, both social and scientific, shows again and again that even the most brilliant thinkers typically grasp only part of the truth, and a fuller understanding comes only after a clash of ideas with others, even when those others are fundamentally mistaken on the whole. Those who insist on a monolithic group ideology are gambling the group's future on being able to achieve such an understanding without this process. Group talents. All individual and group achievements require social preconditions, and therefore vary with the particular culture. But literary and verbal achievements, including political leadership, require much less social foundation than science, mathematics, or engineering. Even relatively backward peoples can produce clever politicians, shrewd demagogues, and masters of intrigue. It was not countries in the forefront of scientific or economic progress that produced Potemkin villages, or the monumental corruption long characteristic of parts of the Middle East, the Far East, Latin America, and Africa. Among the obstacles to economic development is often highly developed political corruption, and an attraction of native talent toward mutually thwarting and socially counterproductive activity, including political intrigue, military coups, and terrorist movements. The transfer of scientific and organizational knowledge from one society to another can be accomplished in a relatively short time, as history is measured. Japan is perhaps the classic example of that. In less than a century, it moved to the forefront of science and technology. But to create the whole range of social preconditions for receiving and applying cultural advances is a more formidable task, especially where the values of the culture are either unreceptive or tend to point people in entirely different directions. In societies or among groups without the skills required for economic productivity and economic organization, politics is, if not the only game in town, then at least one of the few games for which players have the necessary skills. As the main focus of talents and ambitions, politics can readily become both intricate and desperate. Preoccupation with politics may become a substitute for productivity for either individuals or groups. An Idi Amin or an Adolf Hitler could hardly expect to acquire enough economic skills to rise from unpromising beginnings to anything resembling the prominence they achieved in politics. Groups or nations that are generations behind others in economic skills may also seek political shortcuts to importance, whether through ideology, symbolism, confiscations, terrorism, or war. The issues they raise may be highly effective for political mobilization purposes, without being either the real causes of the problems their groups experience or the means of solution to the malaise they feel. However real the social suffering that has catapulted individuals to charismatic leadership, what they offer may represent only illusory solutions to illusory problems. Rationalistic attempts by others to reach compromise solutions with such political leaders may only escalate their demands or breed intransigence on demands that are already unreasonable. The turmoil, which others seek to end in rationalistic ways, may in fact be the very basis of the power held by political leaders. For example, India's attempt to bring peace through intervention in Sri Lanka produced murderous resistance on both sides by factions which have much more power to gain by continuation of the conflict than by its cessation. Ideological visions. Beliefs, attitudes, ideals, and emotional loyalties have long been part of the glue that holds societies together. They have also facilitated or hampered the functioning of government and fueled political movements. More specifically formulated and articulated political ideologies have played a larger and growing role in the two centuries since the French Revolution, first in Europe and in European offshoot societies, and then in other regions of the world to which European ideas were exported. These ideologies have affected race and culture, as they have affected all other aspects of human existence. Among intellectuals especially, ideology can turn facts and morality upside down. For example, one scholar writing of the expulsions of Indians and Pakistanis from the newly independent nations of East Africa wrote, "The crowning disgrace in the treatment of East African Asians came when the United Kingdom refused entry to Asian holders of British passports who had been booted out of Kenya. At least South Africa does not prevent its own citizens from entering its borders. If the mother of parliaments and the cradle of Western democracy behaved more badly than the most racist tyranny in the world, what do Asians have to look forward to?" The ideological pattern of this kind of reasoning extends far beyond this particular episode or this particular intellectual, and so is worth examining more closely for its broader implications. The whole thrust of the attack is not against those in Africa who persecuted the Asians, who forcibly uprooted them from the land of their birth, and who expelled them from countries where their families had roots going back for generations. Moral indignation was not directed towards African governments that virtually confiscated all that the Asians had worked for and saved over several lifetimes, sending them destitute to new lands that most of these Asians had never seen. Instead, the thrust of the attack was against the country which provided them a haven and received them by the tens of thousands, more so than their own ancestral lands on the Indian subcontinent did. Britain was singled out for condemnation as having behaved more badly than the most racist tyranny in the world, simply because it eventually judged that it had reached the limits of its absorptive capacity for a foreign people who had never before lived in Britain, despite their possession of British passports from colonial days. In short, the sins of the Third World were glided over as silently as the humanitarianism of the West, in order to depict the limitations or imperfections of the West as peculiarly vicious. Classic examples of such double standards and selective indignation can also be found in a vast literature on the history of slavery, a literature devoted almost exclusively to slavery in the Western world, with only a relative handful of writings on the larger number of slaves in the Islamic world. Thus, the institution of slavery, existing on every continent and going back thousands of years, is often discussed as if it were peculiar to Western civilization, when, in fact, even the African slave trade was carried on by Arabs for centuries before Europeans took part, and continued for at least another century after the European slave trade to the Western Hemisphere ended. A scholarly, or at least academic, study of slavery has claimed that legal barriers against manumission were among the distinctive characteristics of slavery in North America, when in fact legal barriers to manumission existed in Southeast Asia, ancient Greece, the French Antilles, Suriname, and Curaçao. Reports of how mild slavery was in Islamic countries, and how happy and contented the slaves were there, have been uncritically repeated by writers who would never accept such statements at face value when coming from the white slave society of the antebellum South in the United States. Neither the enormous mortality rates of the trans-Saharan slave routes, nor the virtual absence of an African diaspora in Islamic countries, which took more slaves from Africa than the West did, seems to arouse skepticism about the Middle Eastern version of the story of happy and contented slaves. The biggest story about slavery, how this ancient institution, older than either Islam or Christianity, was wiped out over vast regions of the earth, remains a story seldom told. At the heart of that story was the West's ending of slavery in its own domains within a century, and maintaining pressure on other nations for even longer to stamp out this practice. Instead, the West has been singled out as peculiarly culpable for a worldwide evil in which it participated, when in fact its only real uniqueness was in ultimately opposing and destroying this evil. Yet intellectuals have engaged in desperate attempts to discredit or downgrade the West's long moral crusade, which ultimately destroyed slavery. These attempts have ranged from crude dogmatism about Western economic interests behind the abolition of slavery to elusive insinuations along the same lines. A vast literature exists in which the same general ideological pattern is pervasive, whether the issue is slavery, racism, sexism, or other evils. In this literature, the sins and shortcomings of the human race are depicted as evils peculiar to the Western world, even when such evils have been demonstrably more prevalent or demonstrably worse in regions of the world ignored during outbursts of selective moral indignation. The reasons for such ideological patterns are a large and complex question. What is relevant here is that such ideologies are themselves a political force to be reckoned with. How successful these ideologies will prove to be in undermining the legitimacy of Western civilization, or in polarizing its races, is a question which only the future can answer. Ideological vocabularies. Much of the vocabulary in which racial and ethnic issues are discussed and debated is a vocabulary less suited for clarification than for preventing consideration of factors embarrassing to those who hold a particular ideological vision. For example, performance differences among racial and ethnic groups are ideologically embarrassing to those who wish to present group differences in income or occupations as reflecting differential treatment of groups by society, particularly when it is Western society. The whole issue of performance differences is often verbally preempted by confounding them with differential treatment or initial good fortune through the use of such words as advantage or privilege on the one hand, or opportunity or access on the other, to characterize empirical differences in outcomes. This vocabulary transmutes all performance differences ex post into externally imposed disadvantages ex ante. Any group underrepresented in desirable occupations or institutions is thus said to be excluded, regardless of what the facts may be. While this pattern of verbal preemption has been widely used in discussing minorities in Western countries, such mental habits have become sufficiently general and automatic to be applied in other contexts as well, confusing differential results ex post with differential opportunities ex ante. The whole distinction between the internal characteristics of a group and the external circumstances it faces is thus verbally obliterated. Even without any immediate ideological purpose or intent, such ideologically based mental habits spread confusion, if not tendentiousness. For example, Koreans selling wigs in the United States have been said to face a barrier consisting of their lack of a necessary combination of American business sophistication and capital. Conversely, the success of Lebanese small businessmen in competing with European businessmen in colonial West Africa has been attributed to various Lebanese advantages. The success of the Lebanese in outdistancing their European competitors is based on several factors. Firstly, the Lebanese have lower personal consumption levels than the Europeans. Besides, they have the advantage of having members of the family work in their shops and thus be an economic asset instead of a liability, as was the case with the Europeans. In a situation where Lebanese skill was at least as good as their rivals, they could win over a gradually increasing share of the business by price competition. In addition, the Lebanese skill was in some respects superior to that of the Europeans. The former had many more contacts with the African clients, were willing to talk and bargain with them at length, and therefore had closer knowledge of them. As a result, they could grant credit to the Africans with less risk than the European, could have earlier indication of shifts in consumer demand or crop prospects, and could manage the repayment relationship more skillfully. Another advantage of the Lebanese, in the early days at least, was that little of his profit had to be diverted to the amortization of fixed capital because there was little fixed capital. Thus, successful price competition by the Lebanese merchant was based on the advantages of both lower business and personal costs. Not one of these advantages was in fact an advantage. Each was a difference in performance, whether based on skill or sacrifice. At no point in this process did the Lebanese have any options available that were not equally available to Europeans. The Europeans simply did not choose to subject themselves to many of the conditions which the Lebanese endured. The end result, a supplanting of European businessmen by Lebanese, cannot be described by words which imply an initial condition without ignoring the key intervening factor of performance. For example, if owning little fixed capital was an advantage, why was it confined to the early days, when the Lebanese, according to the same author, started practically penniless as peddlers? In short, why would the Lebanese peddler later choose to relinquish his advantage of owning almost nothing, if that was in fact an advantage? Obviously, it would have been foolhardy For a poor Lebanese immigrant to have taken on the financial burden of buying or renting a shop at a time when he could barely survive as a peddler. But the fact that the Lebanese eventually did begin to own shops and other fixed capital suggests that there was no disadvantage to doing so. The point is much more general than this particular example. Around the world, initial conditions are repeatedly confounded with end results by the use of words like advantage and privilege, or opportunity and access, to describe situations in which there are different performances. Negative words and phrases like discrimination and denial of access are likewise defined to include end results. Groups are said to be denied access to educational institutions, for example, when they simply fail to meet the same performance standards applied to others. Whenever Group A outperforms Group B in any given set of circumstances, those circumstances are said to favor Group A, according to the prevailing ideological vocabulary. Discussions of colonial Malaya, for example, abound in statements that British policy there favored the Chinese, who in fact had fewer rights and less government-provided education available than did the Malays. The issue here is not facts, about which there is little dispute, but rather about the ideological vocabulary in which facts are conveyed, or obscured and distorted beyond recognition. Only one step removed from this purely definitional obscuring of performance differences is the practice of explaining differential business success by saying that one group had greater access to credit than another. When the probability of repayment differs, whether between individuals or groups, those who are better credit risks receive more credit on better terms. To call this better access is again to confuse an end result with an initial condition, ignoring intervening differences in behavior. In the United States, it is common to refer to groups as segregated, not only when there have been special legal or other barriers confronting them, but also where there have not been, if they end up underrepresented relative to their percentage of the population. Discrimination and segregation are and have been among the ugly facts of life in various countries around the world. These facts need to be confronted where they exist, not trivialized by having the terms applied by redefinition to situations where they do not exist and where very different factors need to be confronted. Perceptions and stereotypes are other words in the prevailing ideological vocabulary that serve the very similar purpose of obscuring behavioral differences among groups. Like discrimination and segregation, unfounded perceptions and stereotypes are an important reality in the history and current experience of some racial and ethnic groups. But again, such a condition cannot be assumed a priori merely because of an unfavorable end result. Groups said to be dirty, loud, violent, etc., cannot be arbitrarily assumed to be different, so that all adverse characterizations can be condemned. If the facts are not available, then such characterizations remain unfounded charges, which prove nothing about either the group or their accusers. Yet Cicero's warning to ancient Romans not to buy British slaves because of their stupidity has been cited as racism, even though there was no counter-evidence against Cicero, and what evidence there is about the ancient Britons suggests that they were, in fact, far behind their Roman contemporaries culturally. One of the most used and least defined words in the contemporary ideological vocabulary is racism. The most straightforward meaning of racism is a belief in the innate inferiority of some race or races. This is the sense which conjures up the image of Hitler and the Holocaust. But the word racism is often applied in other very different senses to wholly different situations. To some, every adverse judgment about any aspect of the behavior or performance of any racial or ethnic group is racism. To others, it is only adverse judgments on the behavior or performance of a selected list of racial or ethnic groups, which is racism. Thus, even sweeping denunciations of whites, Anglos, or perhaps Jews may be exempted from the charge of racism. More generally, those particular groups whose historic treatment is part of a general ideological indictment of Western civilization cannot be criticized in any way without risking the charge of racism. Conversely, verbal or even physical assaults originating within such groups are often exempted from condemnation as racism, sometimes by an explicit redefinition which requires power as an essential ingredient in racism, so that blacks, for example, cannot be called racists in American society. If this kind of reasoning were followed consistently, then Hitler could not have been considered a racist when he was an isolated street-corner rabble-rouser, but only after he became Chancellor of Germany. With varying degrees of explicitness, these tendentious ideological redefinitions of racism have become so intermingled with a straightforward meaning, a belief in innate racial inferiority or superiority, that the word may be irretrievably lost as a specific, meaningful concept. The social phenomenon it originally referred to may continue to exist, in varying degrees and with varying effects, but empirical assessments of its existence or importance are unlikely to be clarified by the use of such a chameleon-like word. Indeed, the political overuse of the word may destroy its effectiveness as a warning against a very real danger. Many assume that racism is a prerequisite for discrimination, or is virtually synonymous with it. However, a generalized hostility or specific discrimination may be directed against a particular racial or ethnic group without any belief that they are innately inferior. A political movement organized to ban Japanese immigration to the United States was quite clear about this at their first meeting in 1905. We have been accustomed to regard the Japanese as an inferior race, but are now suddenly aroused to our danger. They are not window cleaners and house servants. The Japanese can think, can learn, can invent. We have suddenly awakened to the fact that they are gaining a foothold in every skilled industry in our country. They are our equal in intellect. Their ability to labor is equal to ours. They are proud, valiant, and courageous, but they can underlive us. We are here today to prevent that very competition. Other groups have aroused resentments in other countries, without any suggestion that they were racially inferior. Often this resentment has been based on acknowledged superior performance. In Honduras, for example, the claim was that the Germans worked too hard for others to be able to compete with them. In India's state of Andhra Pradesh, a leader of the Telanganans admitted that the rival Andhras were better qualified for many of the jobs than we are, but asked, "Are we not entitled to jobs just because we are not as qualified?" With varying degrees of explicitness, many people in many lands have recognized the capabilities of the Jews, the Chinese, the Lebanese, and others as reasons to discriminate against them. If racism is the appropriate label for such behavior, then clearly the word is no longer being used in the sense of a belief in innate inferiority. Sometimes a superiority has been conceded to the group targeted for discrimination. In Nigeria, for example, discriminatory policies were advocated on grounds that otherwise the less well-educated people of the North will be swamped by the thrusting people of the South. In Malaysia, it was likewise argued, Malaysia has far too many non-Malay citizens who can swamp the Malays the moment protection is removed. The fundamental problem with an ideologically defined vocabulary in discussions of racial or ethnic issue is not that those with such a vocabulary may be right or wrong on this or that issue. The more fundamental problem is that we forfeit our ability to examine such issues empirically and allow important social questions to be obscured or the conclusions to be preempted by mere tendentious words. The painful history of racial and ethnic relations is a sobering reminder of the high stakes which make clarity imperative and obscurantism dangerous.